Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. And joining us is one of our good friends, John Andrasik of Five for Fighting, who is just back from Flagstock. And I mean, this is sort of an awesome event that took place. This is the rally for the fraternity, right? That at the University of North Carolina that rescued the American flag from a bunch of anti-American rioters. And I was really happy to see how many people rallied around them.
Yeah, it was quite a unique event. As you mentioned, when that story became an international story of the frat boys who rescued the flag from many of the protesters who wanted to desecrate it and replace the flag at University of North Carolina with a Palestinian flag, these boys just spontaneously said, we're not going to let that happen. And so John Noonan started a GoFundMe to provide a frat concert for these guys, and they actually raised $250,000. So on Labor Day, a bunch of us went out to North Carolina and to the middle of nowhere. And because of security, the kids didn't even know where it was. They actually went to a location, got on buses, and we brought them in. And John Rich from Big and Rich and John Noonan just created an amazing experience, a huge stage, fireworks, flyovers, free beer, Hooter girls, Legionnaires. It was all America. And yeah, you know, they got probably about 1,000 kids there with their families. Each frat that participated in rescuing the flag was given 100 tickets. Of course, security is tight, and some brought their parents. And it was great. It's in a way, it's very sad that we have to do concerts like this, that event was so rare that we wanted to celebrate them. But talking to the kids, especially the Jewish kids after the show and during the show, it meant a lot to them. And I think it's a statement that we're going to stand up to the bullies on campus. And credit to John Noonan and John Rich for putting it on, because I think everybody not only had a good time, but we spoke for freedom and we spoke against Hamas and things that you don't hear at rallies. And the last thing I'll say, Ed, is unlike most of the Palestinian protest riots, there was not one mask in the house. Everybody showed their face. Everybody was happy to smile and take a picture. And so the whole tone was much more uplifting than some of the other protests we're seeing on our campuses.
You know, John, I think you mentioned that to me. I'm not sure if it was a Twitter DM or if you texted it to me, but you mentioned the no masks thing. And I find that very interesting. I don't know if you've seen anything from today, because I've been really busy, been traveling around. But there was CNN's Dana Bash was at a book event. Have you seen this video? It's kind of floating around.
I just saw something on it on Twitter. And I saw that she said something like, show your face or something like that.
Take off your mask, show your face. Yeah. And it was two activists that interrupted this. I don't know if it was a book signing or if it was just a bookstore chat or something like that. But Dana is Jewish. Mm. And they're going after her, not because of anything specific that she said on the air, but because she's Jewish. They accused her of, taking Zionist money. I mean, all these nonsense things. And of course, they had masks on. Right. And that has been sort of it's a feature of these pro-Palestinian riots. They wear masks. This is an Antifa technique, which was more or less enabled or further enabled, I guess you could say, by COVID-19. Nobody's wearing masks for anything other than these protests any longer. And I think it really does say something. You showed your face. The frat boys showed their faces. Most Americans show their faces. Even people who, want to debate, dissent, demonstrate, for the most part, they generally show their faces unless they're fronting for terrorists. And suddenly it changes.
Yeah, I've had some people at my recent shows, start standing up and screaming during the shows. And I think. Part of it has to do with Dana being Jewish, but anybody who has any modicum of support for Israel or condemnation for what's going on is an enemy and will be attacked. It's a pure intimidation tactic. And that's why I think so many people are afraid. And we've talked many times in your show about the disgrace of the arts, where nobody will say anything, particularly about October 7th. You know, iconic artists, even Jewish artists, can't say free the hostages. So the problem is because nobody's saying it, or very few are, people are at risk. You know, if every artist came out and said, you don't have to love Israel, said Hamas is evil, free the terrorists, it's similar to 9/11. There's a good and evil here, and we know what it is. Then we'd all be safe, you know, because you can't go after everybody. And a lot of these college campus kids have been indoctrinated. They feel like they're doing something virtuous. But at the end of the day, most of them are paper tigers. You stand up, you educate them, you talk to them, they collapse. And we're going to do that. There's going to be more things like Flagstock. We're going to go to college campuses. We're going to speak, we're going to perform, we're going to stand with the Jewish kids and the sane kids and many of the faculty who are also under siege, who don't go along with the dogma. So much of it is pushing back and using the arts. But I have seen, I think in New York, they have passed a law that you cannot wear a mask in some of these gatherings, which I think will be very interesting to see. You know, when mom and dad start seeing Junior on TV now without the mask screaming, you know, queers for Palestine, if anything will change. But I think it's a good step. And I think for all of us, you know, who are doing this, I think Flagstock showed how important it was, not just to the kids, but also to the people who are on the other side. You know, of course, the New York Times slammed it. They you know, they hated it. And it makes you wonder, you know, would they be more excited about a concert celebrating those kids who wanted to burn the flag? Part of me thinks they would. I think they'd be more open to that, and maybe have a different temperament for that. And the fact that we had to spend $80,000 to protect college kids who rescued an American flag, I think that's all you need to know about America these days.
I didn't see the New York Times article. Did they really come out and criticize a party?
Of course, first of all, they hate frat boys. They hate, you know, anybody. And they don't like John Rich, you know, because he's a Republican and he likes Trump. But I think, again, I think they sympathize with the protesters. I think many of the New York Times philosophy is that Israel is genocidal. I mean, they're the same newspaper that reported that Israel launched a missile and destroyed a hospital when it was a misfire from the PLO. And they also put a picture on the New York Times of a blown up hospital that was not the hospital that was hit. So, I mean, it's been very clear that most of the media, you know, has been allies in this Hamas propaganda, and New York Times, one of the worst offenders.
You know, I am not sure why they even would bother to comment on something like Flagstock. If they really, to me, it would make more sense to just ignore it, right? To say, it's not really a news story, we're not going to cover it. And that would be fine. But to criticize a frat party, you know, a frat party that was funded by people who were voluntarily donating money. And it's not even a charitable cause, so it's not like they're going to get a tax break on this. Just donating money to let these guys have a pretty cool party. And it's a party. I mean, how much of that? I mean, I didn't see any of it. So I got you know, some information from you about it. But I just assumed that basically you were there to thank them, sing a couple of songs. Other people were doing the same thing. And everybody just has some beer and, you know, fair food, I guess, you know, just have a good time and get together. Am I wrong about that? Or was it a lot more political than that?
Well, my portion of it was, I did not look as political. I talked about the fact that we need to save these kids who've been indoctrinated on the campuses. I thanked them for their moral courage. I talked about the fact that that a lot of this vitriol on campus has to be stood up to, and that they had more courage than all of the university presidents put together. So to me, that's not political, it's moral, but of course in this day and age, but some of the artists did get political. And again, it's free speech, it's a concert, everybody can say what they want. It's called America. And if you go to pretty much any pop concert these days, a Macklemore concert, half of it is ranting against Israel. Half of it is calling Israel oppressors, genocidists. So that's why, you know, it's just interesting. I think the New York Times and many on the left, I think the flagstock thing threatens their narrative because they sympathize with the protesters. Many of them agree with them. So when you have a bunch of boys saving the American flag, many of these folks are not big fans of America, and especially with the election go on. So I think they want to nip it in the bud. They don't want to make these boys heroes. They want to make them kind of, you know, drunken, you know, rednecks. Unfortunately, they're not. I talked to them, and many of them brought girlfriends. I met two IDF soldiers who were women, 20 years old. So the narrative that they're trying to project is not one of reality, and we have to counter that. And as I said, flagstock will not be the first thing we do. And I'm sure the New York Times will be very unhappy with some of the things coming in the next couple months.
I'm glad to hear that. And I was going to make the same point. You know, you go to a Green Day concert. These guys are still around. You know, they're fine. I actually like Green Day.
Me too.
I have a funny story about that. My son thought he'd freak me out by asking me to listen to Green Day. And I actually hadn't heard them up to that point. He was a big fan. He was a teenager, right? This is in the 90s, early 2000s. And he sticks the headphones on me. He says, "What do you think about this?" And then he starts playing it. And I'm going, "This is actually pretty good. That's actually kind of like this. This is good." And he was like, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yeah." Then he surprised me later by becoming a Black Sabbath fan. I was like, "Man, I haven't heard this music for decades. This is good stuff. I didn't know you liked this." So, you know, music's music. And I agree with you. I've never been a shut up and sing kind of guy, right? Yeah. If you want to be engaged in politics, be engaged in politics. And I'm fine with that. Just don't be stupid and be, you know, just don't engage stupidly on it. And be prepared to be criticized for and debated and dissented from. And we're used to that. I don't think the left is used to that, which is the reason why I think the New York Times is complaining about political messaging at flagstock when they don't have a word to say, or maybe only laudatory words to say when other artists do it from the other direction. And this is part of a media culture that has just gone completely poisonous anyway. And we've talked about that in the past. And that makes it hard for you because I know you, you're not out there politicking because you have you know, political ambitions or you really have an ideological point of view. You're out there speaking what you know from your perspective, what you are seeing as morality and truth, and you're trying to defend that. And I've never got the sense from you that this is an ideological crusade for you, or that you're really all that interested in the ideology or the, you know, electoral, you know, horse race stuff. What you're interested in is values and morality. And I mean, if the New York Times doesn't like that, that to me speaks volumes about the New York Times.
Well, I think the New York Times has been embarrassing itself for many years now. And look, they're, you know, they hire people who have a radical left view of the world. So you're going to read that in their headlines. You're going to read that in their op-eds. You're going to read that in their reporters for 90% of it. There's still some very good reporters there, but they're leftist newspaper that has views that don't align with my values for the most part. And one of the groups that I certainly disdain are the mobs on our college campuses indoctrinating our kids. And I'm going to stand up for them, and I'm going to stand up against the faculty that enables them and the presidents. And you're seeing a little pushback. And if New York Times want to pick their side, so be it. And we'll pick our side, and we'll fight it out in the culture war.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that this is a good thing to highlight. And, you know, we've been talking for years, but especially the last couple of years, but the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza against Israel. And I mean, these are moral questions. These are issues that require a certain amount of a moral and cultural foundation. And I think when we're talking about mobs on college campuses, it's not so much the mobs that are the problem. It's the establishment on college campuses that are the problem. It's the administration, it's the faculty that are forming kids to be basically mindless activists as fodder for these types of mobs in order to promote their own ideology. And I've been talking about this for years. And it seems to be getting worse. And I'm curious, I mean, you just had some great interaction with these young men and young women from University of North Carolina. What are they telling you? What were they telling you about the environment at UNC?
Well, again, I think part of the mission of the faculty and many of the administrators was to kind of blow up this concert. And there was a lot of misinformation given, well, the money's going to Washington and everybody's getting rich. No artists were paid. I wasn't paid. They covered my travel expenses. And so, you know, I think the kids that came were brave just to show up, just to be willing to take a picture for Facebook and Instagram. But many of them are just, you know, they're the adults in the room. I was laughing with some of them saying, you know, when you take your classes, you know, you're the adult in that room, not the professor. And, but yeah, the stories, you've heard all the stories, you know, the passive aggressive behaviors, some of assault behaviors. You know, I keep going back to UCLA, my alma mater, when the judge ordered them to allow Jewish students to move freely across campus, appealed that ruling. You know, it's like, what world does that happen in? This world. So yeah, they're incredibly strong, but they're still human beings. I mean, this one IDF girl was worried she was going to George Washington, and she said, you know, do I really want to put on, you know, my Jewish star? Do I really want to fight that? And then she said, well, after coming to this concert, I'm going to do that. So again, it's we live in this insane world, this 1938 world, and but it is what it is. And so, yeah, some kids are strong, some kids are scared. Some kids are kind of lost. They don't understand why all this is happening. And I don't blame them. You know, I don't blame them. You go to college because you worked hard, you got good grades, and now you're on the front lines of the culture war. Nobody asked for that. And they're 18, 19, 20 years old.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, sometimes we lose sight of that, right? We lose sight of the fact that these are, you don't want to call them kids, but they're young adults.
Yeah.
They are really in their first, for most of them, in their first independent, you know, completely independent environment of their life. And they go to these schools expecting these schools to basically deliver the wisdom of the ages, right? Which is what universities really are supposed to be about. The wisdom of the ages, you know, the entire millennia of intellectual and cultural goods that not just the Western culture, but other cultures have created too, because you want to learn about them all. That is not what education has become. Unfortunately, that's not what education has become. And certainly, I'm sure there's some good schools in there. I live near Baylor. I know some of the people over at Baylor, and I've talked to students over there on a couple of occasions, and they are very happy about how Baylor handles this. And, you know, I don't talk too much about my location, but I'm near Baylor. And Baylor is a Baptist university. It's actually a very ecumenical university these days, but it's founded as a Baptist university. It's private. And they try to do a pretty good job of controlling that. And even there, though, you will hear that, you know, well, you got the occupier occupied paradigm that's starting to infiltrate some of the pedagogy there. And it's a real problem. And I don't think America can confront its cultural issues without, I think at first, confronting its issues in academia, because I think that's really the source of much of what is ailing us as a culture. Is it's emanating from these universities that are forming young adults strictly for the purpose of turning them into progressive activists, and that's all the education they're getting is that sort of indoctrination.
When I was in Israel, I was fortunate to spend some time with Natan Sharansky, and he said something to me that goes to your point. He said, you know, 20 years ago, somebody asked me, him, what's the biggest threat to Western democracy, freedom and liberty in the West? And 20 years ago, he said, American academia, because he saw it. He saw it in Russia, you know, when he was imprisoned. It started at the colleges. It started at the schools. It started kids being indoctrinated by faculty, professors, and students. And you're 100% right. At the same time, too, yes, you notice, like, you don't see much of these uprisings and insanity at SEC schools. You don't tend to see it at Alabama. You don't see it at Auburn, you know, the racist schools. Why is that? And there was actually a really amazing chart I saw yesterday that basically said the more money you spend to go to school, which is typically the Ivy Leagues, the more likely you're going to have the indoctrination, the mass riots, the river to the sea kids. So it really is the elite schools. And no, it's not also a coincidence that many of them received hundreds of millions of dollars from Qatar. So there, as you said, if we don't win this battle on the campuses, we will lose the next generation. And that's why I think it's so important to go fight it. And the last thing I'll say is you have to fight it with the arts. And that's what our side never gets. The left gets it. The right has no clue. You have to use the arts. They don't read the Wall Street Journal. They don't listen to speeches by politicians. The arts is where they get their news and their narratives. And that's how we have to get to them and save them. And certainly not me, a 6-year-old guy, but we have to employ the arts to get to these kids. You know, okay, the song I wrote didn't have one spin on the radio, but it's impacted the world globally in way articles and pundits just can't do. So we have to do more of that and inspire people to do that and give people courage to do that. Because I was just on a call about doing some concerts at colleges before this. And there are a couple artists who believe what we believe, but they're afraid to come play. They're afraid for their own safety and their families. And I get it. But at the same time, that was the argument in 1938. And I'm not going to let that pass. So we still have a lot of work to do. It seems like so much has happened, and it has. We're coming up on the 1-year anniversary of October 7th. Of course, the election is going insane and everybody's jumping off buildings. But we can't lose focus on trying to save our kids, because that's what it's really about, saving our kids.
Saving the kids, absolutely. Saving the next generation, saving freedom for another generation.
And 100%.
By the way, you talk about speaking of the arts, and we'll just hit this briefly because of your cap. there you go. USS Ronald Reagan. My friend Mark Judge talks about this all the time, that conservatives have given up on the arts and you just can't do that. And, you know, Andrew Breitbart, he's been gone for far too long now, but he often talked about politics being downstream of culture. You have to win the culture first. And I was wondering if you'd had a chance to see the movie Reagan yet, because you've been super busy. I'm not sure you had a chance to even get over to a theater to watch it.
I've not. I actually was at a dinner with much of the cast a few months ago. I saw some billboards up. So I will be definitely checking that out. I hope it's something that really catches on. Some great actors, and I hear good things. So have you seen it yet, Ed?
I've actually seen it 3 times. Twice up as well, I went to the theater once, and I recommend it. It's very good. And Dennis Quaid does a great job playing Reagan, by the way. You'll really enjoy that. But I mean, that's the type of thing that I'm talking about is using the type of thing that you're talking about, using the entertainment platforms to tell these messages. And I think that when people, if people give it the film a chance, and that's an if, right? Because you know as well as I do, sometimes you just never know what's going to catch. I don't think anybody expected Sound of Freedom to do $200 million at the box office.
Right.
Which is another great example of this. But that's the type of thing I think that you're talking about. It's the type of thing that we have to be a lot more cognizant about.
No, I look into the eyes of 800 kids, you know, who felt that they were in a safe space and that they were listening to people who maybe had a philosophy that agreed with theirs, and they didn't have to worry about getting bad grades or getting assaulted by their friends. It's that, you know, we're in a world that's gotten that crazy. So I think all of us, particularly the artists that are willing to do it, need to stand up for them. And it works both ways. They inspire me. They give me energy to do all this stuff. And when I come out and I say simple truths that I believe and to support them, I think it gives them courage that they're not alone. They're not abandoned, that they're not crazy. So again, we have a lot of work to do, and we'll be doing some things in the fall. But as you know, it's a generational battle, you know. But we just have to stay the course and not get too depressed. And as you said, Andrew was the happy warrior. So I try to keep a smile on my face, even at times when I would rather cry.
Indeed. And he always was, you know. Yeah. He's still an inspiration for so many of us, as are you, John Andrasik. FightForFighting.com. If you want to find out what's going on with Fight for Fighting, go to FightForFighting.com. I know you've got to get to your next thing, so thank you so much for spending a little time with us. I can't wait till we get a chance to talk again.
Thanks, Ed. Always a pleasure.